Hi, everyone. We're back with a special bonus episode from Foreign Policy's Her Power Summit, which took place on April 18th in Washington, D.C., during the World Bank and IMF spring meetings. First, I talked to UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed, and then you'll hear a panel about one of our favorite topics on the show, the role of data in advancing gender equality. Thanks for listening.
And now, please welcome to the stage United Nations Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed for a conversation on achieving the SDGs.
Pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much. So what a treat to have you here. You must, in this week of IMF World Bank, I'm sure you've got your feet up and just hanging out.
Absolutely, but what a better place to hang out than with all these wonderful women.
I thought we'd start out with a report card assessment of how you created the Sustainable Development Goals. Where are we right now? How's it looking?
I would love to say that it's looking great, but it isn't. We had a stock take last year, and from where we came, 4 years of trying to shape a response to what the world needed on the development agenda, 15% is a pretty poor score. What I think the good news is that member states took that to heart, and as hard as it was to get a resolution in response, they did say these goals still matter. It's the only framing that you take to the table that people don't argue about today, and we argue about a lot of things. And so therefore, this is the acceleration for the next 6 years. And so I think an acknowledgement that we've not done well, and there are many reasons for that. Many will say to you, the pandemic, COVID, the war in Ukraine, the current conflict we have in Israel and Palestine, Sudan, the Sahel, and many, many issues will come as why we don't do it. But frankly, before COVID, we were off track. And so important that we pick up the issues of what have pulled us back and not allowed us to lean in to the SDGs, which are so much a part of the response the world has said they need.
I love that you're so honest about the assessment and where we are. You're not blaming COVID. When you're looking to turbocharge these global goals, what will be your focus over the next few years?
So we picked up what people are doing, but just not doing them well enough. I think we recognized that there was a means of implementation gap, which is about not enough finance, not enough access to technology. The trade is unfair. Capacity in institutions to lift this agenda, which is quite big. So we acknowledge that these are big pieces, but how could we boil that down to countries and to donors and to the private sector that we need investments for, that they would say, yes, I can invest in that and it will have impact. And we're looking at the food systems, because we all got a big shock on food security when the war in Ukraine happened. We saw how vulnerable we were, and some countries have the capacity to bounce back, others not.
That's right.
So the food systems is a huge constituency of people. Especially women and young people. Then we thought that has to be powered by connectivity. The era for the digital connectivity is here now, and it's a possibility to leapfrog and not leave people behind. The energy transitions, and it's not just about industrialization and baseload for countries that definitely need that, but it is about going green, and it is about the possibilities of being off-grid because you can go green and connect women. The whole clean cooking that we have struggled for decades can become a reality. And then there are three other issues I think are really important. One is education, and we want to transform education systems now. We learned from COVID how many people fell off the radar. But can we deal with the education skills gap? Because there are many who have gone through education and education not gone through them. We have a bunch of qualified illiterates out there. What are we going to do? You can't tell them that they're not educated. They've got a certificate. So we say, okay, we need to retool. We need to reskill. And it's true, but we've got this fast forward because we can connect to technology. The triple planetary crisis is the context in which we live, but we must be really careful not to stovepipe the development and the climate agenda. They are part of the Sustainable Development Agenda. They're part of the goals come together. But we have to understand that we've got now a home, our living planet, to deal with, and we have to push that 1.5 degree target we have. And last but not least, you can't do this without institutions, people. And that's going to be a really important part of us getting delivery to a social protection floor so that people are not falling below when there's a shock, and that we're looking at decent jobs. So just you're sort of boiling it down to those six areas of investment has helped us. It's not to the exclusion of People will say to me, what about women? Well, for me, if you don't design these 6 investments with women as an outcome in their lives, that they are included, they are empowered, they're also participating in the design, then you haven't done the job. Same with human rights and young people.
When you look at financing for development, it remains a significant issue for countries to meet their SDG targets. When you look at developmental financing, how do people, what do you find is the most effective way in getting that financing to the right people?
I mean, I think whatever financing that we have had over the last decade, let's just even talk about the last 7 years, invariably we have had sufficient experience to get it to the right people. What's happening now is that it's insufficient in its scale. We are drip feeding right now, and we're not getting ahead of the curve of those what we're expected to have. I mean, we're just not doing it. It's not big enough, and it's certainly not urgent enough. So, for instance, we're negotiating a debt deal with Zambia. It takes 3 years. Which person in any developed country is going to take 3 years to know whether they can eat tomorrow? I mean, there are serious issues here about how we talk about getting resources to the people. Resources are getting to people, but they're not sufficient. And so therefore, when a taxpayer says, well, why is not this working? This is a whole lot of money that we've given. It's because it's too little too late. Mm-hmm. And you're not seeing the impact. And you will not until you do what is necessary, $4 to $5 trillion a year to meet the SDGs over the next 6 years. Mm-hmm.
I love your background, the daughter of a Welsh nurse and a Nigerian herder who is now at the top in the international community. You've come from very humble beginnings to where you are today. It's really remarkable. And you know the importance of policy. You know the importance of funding. There's a $360 billion annual deficit in spending on gender equality measures. Why is this particular funding so important at this moment right now?
I think perhaps if we've got any learnings, is that we actually siloed the spending on women when in fact it's an integral part of every spending. Having been a cabinet minister, I would look at my colleague in the Ministry of Women's Affairs, and I would be thinking, what argument is she going to make against the Minister of Agriculture and the Minister of Health and the Minister of Education when they are an integral part of that? And how we pull these figures out, I think matters. So if we can be more expressive about this is the spending across the different sectors and that we're not just siloing it to women alone, then perhaps the Minister of Finance would be more inclined to see this as an investment and not an expenditure. Mm-hmm. And I think investing in what is clearly a dividend to the other half of society is really important to explain. Mm-hmm. And our finance ministers are, you know, these are important people that we've been, at least from my experience in Nigeria, we had great finance ministers who were women. And so therefore the budget itself that was presented to the parliament was far more aware of what expenditures needed to be made when. Now that's just the Minister of Finance. I think the place that we're missing for expenditure on women is the parliaments. Mm-hmm. Parliaments are the ones that appropriate. They appropriate mm-hmm. laws, they appropriate spending, and this is where it needs to be at. And so when we look at our representation in parliaments, it's apart from wonderful countries like Rwanda, it's just not there. Mm-hmm. So we're not being felt. Here, I think civil society can help and really push the boundaries of expenditure in women and girls.
In 2011, I had the opportunity to travel with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to the UN when he tried to push for Palestinian statehood. It didn't happen. 13 years later, now he is going, there's going to be a vote on, he didn't manage to get the votes then. He's managed to get votes to have this, bring this up. If the United States vetoes it, the rules are it fails, they need 9 people to move forward. Do you think this is going to happen for the Palestinians? And if it does not, how do we rebuild Gaza? Where do the Palestinians go from here?
I think it's a very difficult decision, and the geopolitical tensions are clear. Never have we been in a more difficult position where my personal feeling is that we've lost our moral compass on Gaza. I think we've lost it on Sudan, in many places where we needed to take decisions that we should have. If they don't get the vote today, they will live to fight another day as they have done for the decades before. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have to be there is to stand up for people. And to continue accompanying them on that journey, just as we say, don't forget the girls in Afghanistan. It's not over yet. And until they have their rights to everything, education, health, the economy, it's not done. So I think this is another step in a very important journey for the Palestinian people, and we hope that member states will take the right decision. Mm.
You said don't forget the girls. Afghanistan, Boko Haram, you have personally understood living there, the situation of not forgetting the girls. In Israel, they felt it took 50 days for the UN women to acknowledge the rapes, the sexual violence there. Why did it take so long for UN to come forward and acknowledge that?
I don't think that's true. I think that that's just selective media. It didn't take that long for UN women to express their outrage and their concerns. I think everyone was shocked. What happened in Israel on October the 7th should never ever happen again anywhere. And we need to bring back every single hostage. We've had hostages who've come, who have been released, who've come to speak to us in the UN. They speak to the SG frequently. They've spoken to me. We have hostages that I know personally in Nigeria. It's not just our Chibok girls, it's thousands. Thousands we're able to get back, others not. And I think that, you know, the UN as a whole, including UN women, did step up and they have spoken and they continue to. So I hope that we can do more, because we should. We need to amplify the voices that come out of the UN. It cannot just be the UN alone. Each and every one in this room is a member of the UN. Your governments are members of the UN. And it's not just the agencies, funds and programs.
I love your personal story so much, as I mentioned, because you are a testament that no matter where you come from, there's opportunity for people, which I think there's so many people watching at home and here in the room. I came to Washington as a college student, so this city has so much hope for me. What do you say for the young women coming up? This episode on our podcast focused on girls. To the women who in their hearts, the young girls who want to one day become you and Amina Mohammed, what's your advice?
Well, they can become so much better than me.
You know? You've got a pretty impressive background.
I've been standing on people's shoulders. I was in a conversation with Prime Minister Mia Motley, and I was thinking, yes, I want to be like her when I grow up. And I've got not much growing up to do, right? And I'm in my 60s. But I think that for every person, you need to open up more spaces. And those spaces, you need to occupy them. And once you occupy them, don't let them go. You've got to stay there and make that place better than when you met it. So I asked myself, you know, as I'm leaving the UN in a couple of years' time, is it better than when I came in? Yes, it is. We have 50% parity with all management positions in the United Nations, 131 offices where we had just men leading. We have 50% that are women and amazing women. To bring women in every aspect that we can see, you know, whether we're talking about a community of LGBTQI or we're talking about disabilities, indigenous people, all of them are women. And so we need to bring them into that space and occupy it. But dream big. And I think, you know, life is a journey. Every step matters. Make the networks work for you. Today, I look back. Look, I'm looking at Geeta, and Geeta has been with me for decades. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we reconnect all the time. So in that journey, your networks matter, who you pull up as you're walking along. Mm-hmm. Because when you're coming back down again, you're probably going to see them passing you on the way up.
Touché.
And you want to make sure you still have that connection, because everyone needs a touchstone. Mm. Kofi Annan used to be mine, Grasa Machel is, and so you always go home to say, did I do that right? Even as I am now, I'm still checking, was that right? Did I connect? It's lifelong learning, and it is a continuous fight and effort to try to occupy the spaces that we should have been in a long time ago, but also make sure you keep them. Don't let them go, because it's too easy to get into that space. It's even, you know, it's too easy to lose that space, I should say. Mm-hmm. Hard to get in, but much more difficult to retain that space.
UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed, we're so grateful you could join us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next, please welcome to the stage Data 2X Executive Director Krista Jones-Batista, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Senior Program Officer Jennifer Hansel, Chief of the UN Women's Research and Data Section Papa Sek, and Head of the World Bank's Women Entrepreneurs Finance Initiative Secretariat Wendy Teleki, for a conversation with FP's Executive Vice President Allison Carlson on data and the foundations of gender-inclusive policies.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing this morning? Thank you so much for joining us, those that are here in the room,
and those who are joining online from around the world. I'm so excited about today and about this conversation in particular. As you've already heard, this is about real conversations about what matters and what is needed to really drive impact. That's why we're here today, because you all care about it and are working in some way toward better, more impactful outcomes for women. And so thank you again for being here. And thanks to all of you for joining me. I'm thrilled about this panel because we're going to be focusing on the power of precision. And I love the title of it as well, because it's an issue that doesn't get as much attention as is needed, and we need to focus on it more. And what is that? It's data, which is the foundation of economic development decisions, policies, investments, and it's really what can inform the decisions we're all making to drive greater and more equitable outcomes. And each one of our experts here today are working very much at the forefront, but in different ways, on this issue. And so, you know, what we do know is while data is fundamentally important, it is often fragmented, not collected systematically, not reported well, and it's often based on cohorts of men that are often driving then information that is biased and having incredible gaps. And so the question before us today is, what can we do about this? How can we really focus on greater, more robust, sex disaggregated data to inform policies so that those policies are more inclusive and equitable and drive greater outcomes, not just for women, but for everyone? And so to start off the conversation, Krista, I'd like to turn to you first. As the executive director of Data2X, you're a data specialist. Why is gender disaggregated data important, and why does it need to be prioritized?
Thanks so much, Allison. It's such an honor to be here today and to be on this panel with all of you. Data2X has been working at this intersection of gender equality and data innovation for the last 10 years. And our focus is really to work in, not as a solitary endeavor, but to bring together stakeholders around the world, UN agencies, governments, private sector, academics, civil society organizations, to look at the ways that gender data can contribute to more gender equal policies and evidence-based policies. So this is the perfect conversation, and again, so glad to be here. So I want to highlight why gender data is so critical to both women's economic power and economic growth. We don't know what we can't measure. And we know that the lived realities, the gender data around women's lives, is unique, and it's intersectional, and it's complex. If we think about the range of policies that governments are making, you know, today, right, in the world, things like around transportation, time use, education, health, all of those aspects of our lives are driven by our lived realities as men and women face and diverse genders. And so it's really critical that we look at what the data gaps are. And Data2X's research has really looked over the years at where those gaps exist and where and how we can fill those gaps. And again, this is really something that we work at the global level, but we also work at the country level. So for example, we're working in Kenya with the Women's Rights Advisor to the President on ways that we can systematically release in really important national level data sets, for example, in relation to time use, and not only look at that data from the official statistics perspective and do the analysis and the policy briefings, but also to go out into communities and be inclusive and work with those individuals in those communities so that they too can understand how data can be used, how it can impact their daily lives. And so I think what we really have seen and what we need to be committed to going forward is furthering this objective of identifying those data gaps, financing the closing of those gender data gaps, and then being inclusive and bringing that conversation out as we do our work globally.
To pick up on something that you said about national statistics and how it's informing programs, and Papa, turning to you, as the chief and who's been driving data and research for gender specifically in UN Women, can you explain how and why you recognize this as absolutely vital to your work and the ways in which your work and the work of the division is really informing gender-inclusive, data-driven policies and investments around the world?
Great. Thank you very much, Alison, and thank you for inviting me to this fantastic event. It's really a pleasure to join you all. And just to say, you know, again, I've been at UN Women for about 15 years now, and, you know, gender data has just grown organically, and it has become really a cornerstone of what we do, right? So, you know, essentially, I mean, we get stuck if we don't work on data. I think it has really become very clear for us, but also particularly for our country offices and partners. And, you know, again, we always talk about the gaps that we have. But I think sometimes we also need to celebrate the gains that we've made. And, you know, having been on this journey for quite a while, I've seen the progress that we've made. And this is really over the last, you know, 7-8 years, where we've really seen, I think, gender data take off. We still have gaps, but we've gone from 26% of SDG indicators to now 52%. That's a massive progress. If we also think about the fact that, you know, we've had COVID in between, right, where, you know, investments have dwindled and et cetera, but, you know, I think we need to celebrate that kind of progress. And one thing that we've seen, I think, again, because we've just done an evaluation now of our work on gender data in general, and there are several lessons that come in terms of, you know, how do you anchor this work at the national level? Issues related to, you know, a coordination of actors working on gender data. Issues related to capacity development, coordination, and so forth. Those are all important. But I think two of the key lessons that we've seen is that you really need to anchor whatever you do into national plans. Right? So if national plans are out of the picture, then whatever you're doing is not sustainable. Right? So, and, you know, sustainability is really what we should aim for. At the same time, you know, once you anchor into national priorities, then your countries are more motivated to actually use the data. And that's really where what we should aim for. It's not data production, it's data use. Right? Use of the data to improve the lives of people. And, you know, with that kind of approach, we've really seen, you know, massive progress. You mentioned Kenya. Kenya is an example where we conducted a time use survey in 2021, which is now leading into, you know, the country's first national care policy, which will benefit millions of women. And this is an investment of what? $1 million? That will probably generate leverage over $100 million for a care policy, right? So those are the benefits that we should aim for. We've seen that in many other countries. You know, Senegal is another example, and I can cite a few. But, you know, we also need to be cognizant of the fact, and I'll close with that, the fact that, you know, data is now much more than just national statistical offices, right? It has become a commodity. It is now indispensable, right? We are in the age of AI. This is not optional, right? Data is not optional in this case. We really need to start focusing on gender data, and this is an area where, frankly speaking, we are still behind the curveball, so we really need to catch up. But, you know, another area that I'm really passionate about, which is, you know, citizen-generated data, right, which we are spearheading some a nice initiative now, a collaborative with the UN Statistics Division and others, and we're really trying to bring citizens into the discussion of data, on data, so that, you know, they can benefit from it, they can produce it, they can use it, and so forth. So I'll leave it there, but, you know, again, just to say that I think the opportunities are really limitless.
Thank you for that. You point out so many important things, including we should celebrate the gains, and point very well taken, because I think you're right, we do focus on the gaps a lot, importantly, but we do need to celebrate the gains, and I'm curious, in the progression over time and focusing on those gains, what some of the accelerants can be to those gains. And that leads to this conversation today, is what we need to be prioritizing to go further and go faster, because the impacts are great. And it's well noted what you say about national plans as well. Our analytics division, FP Analytics, Informed Policy, has been doing a few different studies of cross-country research focused on safeguarding childhood is one of the projects, and really relying on national statistics about child abuse. And the data sets are sparse and they aren't reported. And so finding ways to strengthen and obtain robust data sets that are sex disaggregated and transparently reported is just incredibly challenging. And so your point is very well taken. And Jennifer, I'd like to turn to you and, you know, picking up on, Papa, what you said about really needing to collect the data. And so in your work with the Gates Foundation, and when you're thinking about economic surveys and ways that that data can be collected systematically and at a local level and reported, so that it is, you know, building this and strengthening a repository of data that's accessible, how are you going about that?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me on the panel. It's an honor to be here. And at the Gates Foundation, data and evidence is highly prioritized. And currently, we're working with many multilateral partners, as well as all the colleagues sitting on this stage here with me, particularly the World Bank, the IMF, the ILO, and the UN, to improve gender data. To date, the foundation has added or shaped gender indicators through major surveys and 12 million data points in 90 plus countries. And one way to reduce cost, because it can be quite expensive to collect data, is to really integrate economic gender data into existing surveys. So I'd like to give two examples. One is with the World Bank and the other is with the ILO. So with the World Bank, we're working with 13 country national statistical offices, and we're including gender data into the census, labor force surveys, household surveys, and the enterprise surveys. And the goal really is to improve and institutionalize both the collection of the data as well as the use of data to inform WE policies as well as programs. With the ILO, we've been working in recent programs and current programs on informality and care. So in a lot of the lower and middle income countries, the majority of employment is in the informal sector. And so being able to understand the informal economy is essential. And also we want to be able to measure care. So we have worked with ILO to develop standards on informality, particularly regarding asset ownership within businesses, earnings, access to finance, ICT usage, and others. An interesting new novel study that came out that might be of interest is, in the informal sector, women's income does not increase the longer they're in jobs, the same it does in the formal sector. Men, however, their income increases whether they're in the informal sector or the formal sector. So just an understanding, if we're looking to increase the income and economic power of women, we need to better understand the informal sector as well as the formal sector to be able to increase those incomes. The ILO has built tools and standards, and they're rolling them out in different countries to be able to measure the informal sector through labor force surveys. And in the coming years, this will be transformational and have enormous impact in understanding work. And regarding the care economy, we have been working to build tools and time use surveys or time use measurement practices for also countries to measure this in their labor force surveys. We're doing this in Kenya, which will be coming in a survey, a labor force survey that they'll be doing soon. And another area that we're working, when we talk about the care economy, which is a slightly newer and something that for decades has been a challenge for us to be able to measure both unpaid care as well as paid care work, is we are developing a standard. So at the next International Statistical Conference, ICLS, we will have a standard
to have a better definition of care, and we can all speak the same language when we're talking about care, and to really measure women's, particularly women, but all, everyone's work in this sector. Thanks.
Thank you for that. And your comments about the informal economy are so incredibly important, and the amount of work and labor that, you know, goes unrecognized and unremunerated. And so how we can more systematically understand that landscape and then develop policies to be more supportive of women will have, you know, iterative and cascading impacts throughout economies. And, you know, this idea of translating data into impact is so important. And Wendy, I'd like to turn to you and thinking about the role of women in local economies and all of our growing economies. How do you think about that? And with your work with WeFi specifically, how this data is so incredibly important to unlock access to capital, for example, and provide the resources, financial support to support entrepreneurs and others who are, you know, the lifeblood of small communities, especially in low and middle income countries.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having me here. I'm really excited to be here and to be able to talk about this topic that I'm really passionate about. So WeFi sits at the World Bank, and we work with all of the multilateral development banks to support women entrepreneurs in developing countries. There's about 400 million women entrepreneurs around the world, and in developing countries, women are twice as likely to be entrepreneurs or aspire to be entrepreneurs than in developed countries. So it's a much bigger part of our challenge and opportunity in the countries in which we work. WeFi is working in about 80 countries now, and a big focus of our work is to close financing gaps for women entrepreneurs. And we do this by working with banks, by working with regulators, working with financial infrastructure and others to close those gaps. There's about a $1.7 trillion financing gap for women entrepreneurs. And when we try to deploy our instruments, work with financial institutions, work with regulators, we find a lot of friction. And when we tried to look at what kind of the key bottleneck was in trying to address these gaps, data was clearly at the center of that, and the lack of data. And let me explain, you know, what that looks like. We as multilateral development banks, we have capital that we can put into banks, microfinance institutions, and other financial service providers to provide financing to women-led businesses. We have the technical capability to work with regulators and others. But when we go to banks, for example, and we say, you know, we want to fund you to do more work with women entrepreneurs, sometimes those banks are interested, sometimes they don't really see the business case. But generally what we often hear is, oh, we're fine, we do a good job, we don't discriminate against women when they come to us. When we actually are given the opportunity to unpack that with financial institutions and usually not look at the data because the data doesn't exist, but help them create the data and understand what the data is, they might have 10% of their portfolio going to women or 20%. And this is with, you know, the banks. Microfinance institutions we know do tend to lend more to women entrepreneurs. They're shocked when they see that. And by the way, this is a pattern that happens in developed countries as well. When banks actually look at how much financing is going to women-led entrepreneurs, they're shocked. 10%, 15%, 20% is very, very common. Likewise, when we work with regulators, they have very good intentions to do more to improve financial inclusion. They have financial inclusion plans. They try to put policies in place. But they find they're pushing on a string when it comes to getting the private sector to report more data and collect that information, and more importantly, use that data. So across the ecosystem, we're really challenged to get more financing out the door because this lack of data. And data for data's sake isn't all that we're looking for. We want to be able to use that data. We want to be able to use that data to design products and services that really meet the needs of women. We want to use the data to understand how products are working for women, which they're really taking advantage of and which they're not. We want policymakers to understand which policies are working, which banks are really doing a good job on financing for women, help their financial systems learn and understand better how to serve those women entrepreneurs. And for us in the multilateral development banks, we're interested in making sure women have equal opportunities. We're meeting our SDG goals. We're trying to put more financing out the door. And to do that, we need to be able to deploy capital in a responsible way and make sure that our money is not just getting to one woman or two women, but really moving the needle systematically in these countries. And we're working across the ecosystem. We're very happy to be working with, for example, UN Women and the Gates Foundation on a new initiative we call the We Finance Code, which is now being rolled out in 26 countries to bring together the regulators, the bankers associations, funds, fintechs, all to accelerate the collection of data and action to support more women entrepreneurs in these countries. And that will help drive growth in these countries as well. Women entrepreneurs employ significantly more women proportionally than male-led firms, so we see this also as a way to drive labor force participation and growth in the countries that we're working in. So it all starts with data, but it radiates out from there if you can really take a systems approach and an ecosystem approach, which is what we're trying to do.
Thank you for that. And Jennifer, I'd like to pick up on that with you. And as there is, you know, more action being taken when you're shown the evidence, you have the data to demonstrate what is perhaps radically different than what has been perceived. You know, when you're thinking about evidence-based and results-oriented measurements and closing those gaps and these kinds of partnerships, how is the Gates Foundation focusing on that specifically and in partnership, understanding everyone has a complementary but differentiated role to play in this, right?
Sure, thanks for that question. We are working to close the gender gap in many ways, including the financial gap that Wendy was just talking about. And I'd like to give three examples. One is working on the implementation of the WE policy in Nigeria. And would like to flag that they're using the Women, Business, and Law Report and the World Economic Forum Economic Opportunity Sub-Index to measure progress. So I think one thing is using these existing data sets to show how we're improving or not improving, as the introduction was saying earlier today, is one area you want to flag. The other is regarding the care policy. And the Gates Foundation has really been working a lot in collecting the data. So first of all, we did the time use survey that was mentioned earlier in October 2023, and that was in the 2021 Kenya Continuous Household Survey. That was then used to inform the National Care Needs Assessment, and this is working with the UN. And then that developed the National Care Policy Roadmap. And now we're working with the government and other partners with the UN to take the time use survey, the needs assessment, and the roadmap to inform an evidence-based policy on care at the national level. And the third example I'd like to point out is today, or actually last night, at the spring meetings, we released a white paper. So on everyone's table, you should have a policy brief. And really, it's talking about the different capital interventions that are on a spectrum, from highly concessional, so if you're thinking about ultra-poor graduation models, to fully commercial, so SMEs that get unsubsidized loans from a bank. And one of the issues, particularly that Wendy was talking about, is how do we understand the risk of the borrower? And when we don't have the data there, sometimes there is a higher risk than is actually there. And so in Africa, a lot of people women have an APR of 70% APR, which is huge. So how do we get women getting better, fairer, more affordable financial products? And how do we get commercial banks to do this? And so one way is through more data and evidence and transparency of that data. And one, we wanted to flag Kalidafin in India is one organization that's really sort of doing this in a creative way and making sure that you can have a credit history and you can show that women are, say, less risky. And we can also hopefully design better financial products depending on where you are on that spectrum. So this is for everyone and especially for women who we know are not getting, there's this huge gap that we're trying to fill in that in finance.
Thank you for that. And please do dive into that brief on your tables. And I think one of the things that's really exciting is about the tools and the resources that are available. I think there are so many that are trying to understand and learn, you know, how can they in their respective roles engage in this and learn from, you know, what has been learned to date, lessons learned. And so I think that policy brief is a real distillation of that. In the last few minutes we have, I'd like to talk about what's new and ways to fill the gap. Innovations that are happening. Papa, you referenced civilian-driven data collection. And you know, Krista, I know you've been working and thinking about AI and machine learning. Like, how can we utilize and harness new tools and innovations, which certainly have the need for guardrails as well, to be clear, but I do think there's opportunities to fill some of these gaps with new ways and new tools. And so, Papa and Krista, I'd like to turn to you in the last few minutes, and then I have a hot round for all of you before we go. But when you think about those new tools and different means to fill in those data gaps, what are you seeing that's working well and that we should be leaning into?
Yeah, go ahead, please. Start.
I'm sure we have similar things, possibly. Yeah, but, you know, we're already seeing ways that AI can be used to visualize, analyze, and harmonize data sets. And I'm really cautiously optimistic that when we see the ways, for example, that AI can be used to automate data queries across different data sets. This is happening already in many of the organizations represented in this room or that we're working with. And this can really help us get at this using data in new ways. I think we're at the kind of peak of the hype cycle with AI, and so I think it's really imperative and kind of urgent that we engage in this space and think about things like, as Papa alluded to, we're already a bit behind on the AI and gender data space. And so before we jump full force into AI, I think we need to really understand where the gaps are, what biases are already baked into AI systems, engage with the private sector on addressing kind of current mitigation measures, human audits, this like pairing that we heard about earlier of a human and an AI system, and then also take some proactive measures ourselves to prepare data sets to be ingested and used by machines in collaboration with humans. And really thinking about how to be inclusive and co-create the AI tools that can really drive the impacts that we all are working toward. There's innovations happening, but I don't necessarily see those being shared widely. And so that's another area where I think all of us can be working. These things are taking place at global institutions like many of ours, but also in the ground, you know, in Africa, in Asia, and Latin America. So how do we make sure we're amplifying those successes and bringing those stories cross-regionally and taking multi-sectoral approaches to keep it brief?
Yeah, no, exactly. I think my intervention actually goes in the same direction. It's really about sharing and bringing also new communities into this conversation. So you mentioned AI. I think, you know, the one that I'm actually more excited about these days is citizen-generated data, right? So, you know, it's a whole new paradigm. It's a whole new ballgame, I think, when we are talking about that. There are instances where we actually don't want governments to measure. We want the information to come from citizens, from third parties. And this is really about that. And, you know, that's one area where we've seen tremendous growth in a very short time period, and really different communities who've been working for a long time in these areas, but basically in silos. So the fact that we're now able to bring these communities together, I think really gives us, I think, a whole new set of options for, you know, improving data, not just official data, but gender data in general.
It's exciting, and I'm thrilled to be, you know, ending this conversation on that note and in that spirit. And so I'd like to go to each of you quickly and thinking about that and going back to something that you said earlier about the accelerants. We are holding Her Power today alongside the IMF World Bank spring meetings where, you know, a number of leaders in very powerful positions are making decisions and discussing policies, investment priorities. And so from where you all sit and the work that you're doing and as it relates to sex disaggregated gender data to inform more inclusive policies in the speed round, what should they be focusing on? I'm going to turn to you first, Wendy.
Thank you. One of the things that's been very heartening about this work that we're doing on the We Finance Code is the very strong level of collaboration across all of the MDBs. So we're working with the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, African Development Bank, Asian Development Bank, IFC, World Bank, Islamic Development Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, all to deploy this code. So at the MDB level, we all have a single goal that we're working towards. And then in these 26 countries where we're deploying the code, we're building across the whole ecosystem a common goal, common commitments to that goal, and then a supporting infrastructure so that there's reinforcing incentives across that. And just very quickly, I'll give a great example of Dominican Republic, where they've launched the code in November. They brought together every financial institution, every bank, and many of the funds, fintechs there, and they're really very, very actively, very quickly moving towards getting common definitions, common commitments to collect the data, a process for collecting the data, learning about how to analyze and use the data, build the business case in a time frame that is unusual for data projects. They tend to be slower, but this is really creating incentives and enthusiasm and building leaders who are really advocates for this also in the country to keep it moving forward. So that common vision, the common goal, and that leadership element are really critical. And bringing the World Bank and the rest of the multilateral banks together to help catalyze that and make it happen has been a really powerful tool because of where they sit, both looking at policy and private sector investments. So they have a lot of tools at their disposal to do that.
Great, thank you for that. And we're over time, so I'm gonna turn in just a few words, the priorities for each of you, or otherwise I'm going to get in trouble with my team for running over time again. But Krista, over to you.
Great. Sure. So I would say to continue the progress on closing the gender data gaps, as well as prepare for the innovations that are ahead of us, we need to continue to ensure that there is financing for gender data initiatives and gender data systems.
Thank you. Papa?
Yeah, I'm absolutely with Krista. Without the money, we're not going to go. I mean, we will make progress, but it will be very slow. So I think investments are absolutely critical. We know what works, but we are now currently, I think we really need to step up on investments.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Jennifer?
Thanks. In a tight fiscal space, I think one of the things that we want to think about is women as part of that solution. And so when you're looking at economic growth, when you're looking at how do you build that economic growth, we have to consider women in those policies, whether it's fiscal policies, whether, you know, even monetary policies, labor policies. Women are half of the population, and they are part of that solution when we're looking for creating more jobs, a safer place to live, and they've got to be part of that conversation and part of the solution.
Absolutely. Well put. Thank you for your work, your insights, and for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you,
Carol. Thank you.
And that does it for today's show. The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women is a production of Foreign Policy and is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Roberta Buffett Institute for Global Affairs at Northwestern University. The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women is hosted by me, Rena Ninen. Laura Rosbrow-Tellum is our senior producer. Rob Sachs, our managing director. We'll be back in your feed in the fall with brand new episodes all about women's leadership. Till then, thanks for listening and be well.